Dr. Haber?
I don't think he can hear you.
What happened to him?
Nobody seems to know exactly. He was on the verge of an enormous discovery.
And now?
A breakdown. Ever since the night that everything fell apart, you know?
You've seen it, haven't you? The world after April.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest today, Joe Walton. Joe, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself and where we can find you online?
Hi, I'm Joe Walton. I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer. I have published 15 novels, including the Hugo Nebula Award-winning Among Others. My most recent novel is called Or What You Will. I'm published by Tor. You can find my books in all good bookshops. You can tell they're a good bookshop because they'll have my books in them. And online, I have a podcast with Ada Palmer called Ex Urbe Ad Astra, which you can find, and I'm on Twitter as Blue Joe Walton.
And I have to tell you, I'm very much fangirling right now. You are an absolute dream guest of mine. So if you see me just fangirling, apologies in advance.
It's fine. And I also blog about what I read every month on Tor.com, and I sometimes do extended posts on older books. But I used to do that a lot, but I've kind of cut down to just doing reading posts mostly now.
And I've purchased many a paperback based on the reading lists that you have posted on Tor. And something that I really appreciate about those reading lists is it's new books, it's old books, it's fiction, it's nonfiction. And I appreciate that because that's how I read as well, just a little bit of everything. I'm fascinated to know what makes a book interesting to you.
That's a really difficult question. It's mostly the way that it's written. Because I can read anything as long as it is written in an engaging way. And there are things that I need to read for research that are not written in an engaging way, and I've got to really drag myself through them. And if you read my reading posts on Tor, I will say that I will say this is a great book about a particular subject, if you really want to know about a particular subject, but this is not fun. And other times I will say, this is a book on a really obscure little niche subject that very few people are going to be interested in, but it's a really fun, readable book that you want to read. So it's readability more than anything else. There is a quality of writing which we don't talk about very much, which is just how much reading each sentence makes you want to read the next sentence. And there are some writers who really have that ability, who pull you through the text you want to keep on reading. And then when you come back and read it again, you want to read it again. It's not just you want to find out what happens. It's a way that something is written. And if something has that, I'm all over it. And if something doesn't have that, then it is hard work. And I will give up on books if I'm not having a good time, unless I really need to read it.
Those books that I love how you put that, because that's so true. If you consistently want to keep reading, I read mostly fiction, and I find that those books become my comfort reads, the books that I go back to, because it's so enjoyable and it just feels so good to read them.
And I think with comfort reading, there are some books that are comfort reading because the plot is comforting and no bad things happen and it's all sort of smooth and comforting. And there are others that just are comforting because they are so absorbing that while you're reading the book, you're in the book and you're not somewhere else. So during the pandemic, one of the things I reread was C.J. Cherry's Chenier books that start with Pride of Chenier. And those are nobody's comfort reading. There's a review of Rim Runners that says, never a dull moment and rarely a safe one. And I think that really covers most of Cherry. I love her work, but they are not comforting. But reading them at a time when I was unhappy was comforting, because while I was reading them, I was worried about the characters and the kiff and all of the things that were happening, and not about my own life and the things that were happening in the real world. And I think there's a definite kind of comfort in that, in just being drawn into a book that can really, really pull you in and make you forget about other things.
Yes, and it's like my comfort reads as well are, I would not describe them as safe, happy, gentle books. Some recent comfort books that I reread fairly recently was The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch. Not a lot of safe moments, lots of violence, lots of... I'd actually forgotten how much violence is in that book. And The Incrementalists by Stephen Brust and Skylar White. Not really a safe book, but very absorbing and very compelling. And I know what happens at the end of both of those books. I've read them many times, but I was still so worried about every single character.
Yeah. There is a thing with rereading where it can be comforting in a way that reading anything for the first time isn't, because you know both that the characters are going to be okay or that they're not. You're braced for it if they're not. But also, you know that the book is going to be okay. You know that the book is not going to fail you at the end. I read Piranesi when it came out, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It's Susanna Clarke's best book, in my opinion. I really, really enjoyed the reading process more than with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell, which I admire a lot. But I loved Piranesi, and there's a different thing between admiring a book and loving a book, and I just loved Piranesi. And yet, the whole first time I was reading it, I was apprehensive, not just about the character being okay, but that she was actually going to pull it off. That there were things that I was afraid were going to happen that would just make it fail as a book. There were some very conventional plot things she could have done that I'd have hated, and she didn't do them. And because she didn't do them, then when I read it a second time, I could really relax into it and really enjoy it, because I knew that it was going to be there. I didn't need to worry that I had to have an emotional safety net for the book, because I knew that I didn't. I knew that it was going to be good.
Oh gosh, I love rereads, like exactly for that reason. Like you can have all of the emotions and all of the oh gosh, is this going to be okay? Are these characters going to be okay? That you had in your first reread, But yes, you phrased it perfectly. You've got that emotional safety net because you know that the ending is going to be what you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that so much.
Yes, it's like taking a journey for a second time. You recognize the twists in the road. You may not remember what's over every hill, but you know where you're going.
Yes, yes. You know things are going to be okay, but you don't quite remember how you're going to get there. And it's just, it's wonderful because you kind of know the destination. You could give more attention to those little those details that that at least I rushed through the first time.
And also, you know what's going to happen, and so you can see the foreshadowing, and you can see, you know, and the characters meet for the first time and they're very wary of each other, but you know they're going to be best friends, and you can see that friendship develop in a way that you just can't the first time through. That, you know, you watch it develop, but you see it foreshadowed. Or if there's going to be a betrayal, you can see that foreshadowed when they meet. And there's this wonderful thing where how happy somebody is before the betrayal is sadder for you rereading it than it possibly could be, because you know and the character doesn't know what's around the next corner.
Oh gosh, and I just went through that with a book that I reread where these particular characters are so built up. And the build-up is just so fun and so enjoyable. And I know that they die at the end.
Yeah.
And so that build-up was just heartbreaking for me, because I know that they don't make it to the end, but they don't know that.
Yes. Yes.
And just heartbreaking.
And it's difficult to talk about this without spoilers. And usually you're talking about books that you really do not want to spoil. Because as I say, rereading is forever, but reading it the first time unspoiled is only once. And you don't want to spoil that experience for other people. So I was just thinking, when I was thinking about the friendship betrayal thing, there's an example of that in perhaps The Stars, the fourth book of Ada Palmer's Terra Ignota books. And when I reread all four of them, I was seeing every moment of that friendship in the light of the betrayal. The first time, I didn't have that to light it. So the shadows I was seeing were different, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I know exactly. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, and it's giving me shivers to even think about that for how many times. It's that is the science fictional technological advance that I most want, is something that will erase my memories of having read something so I can read it again for the first time.
Have you seen the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yes.
Or the it's based on a short story that I've forgotten. I think it's John Kessel. It might be James Patrick Kelly. I always get those two confused. They're both great writers, particularly a short length. But anyway, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Lacuna Corporation, where they wipe memories out of their mind. And of course, in the movie, they do it to remove a love affair. But if that exists, in fact, when I saw it, I walked out of the cinema after seeing it, and I said to my son, if that existed, I would use it to erase the memory of books. Not actually so that I could read them for the first time, but books that I've read that I'm sorry exist, usually sequels to books that I love, where the sequel spoils the earlier book. Most notably, the one that I said to my son was Xenocide, Orson Scott Card's Xenocide, because I read Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead back in the 80s before he was born, and I loved them to pieces. And then I read Xenocide, and Xenocide retroactively spoiled the earlier books. This is before Card came out as a homophobe and all of this stuff that he's more recently sort of come out as. But just Xenocide spoiled the earlier books, and I can't forget it. So I said, if Lacuna Corporation existed, I would totally go to them and wipe out my memory of Xenocide. And my son said, yes, okay, but just like the guy in the film, the next day you'd pick up the book and read it because you wouldn't remember. Why not?
Now I know why I just keep reading Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead over and over and over and over again and feel absolutely no yearning to read Xenocide.
Don't ever read it.
I don't even own a copy of it.
And people sometimes say, are there books that I hate? And all of the books that I feel that I hate or that I wish I hadn't read are all sequels, where the sequel spoils the earlier book. So whenever there is a sequel to something that I really love, I am slightly apprehensive as well as excited in case it's going to do that and it's going to take away the experience that I can repeat of rereading the earlier book, if it's going to do that. Another example that I don't mind giving, because I've actually talked to the author about this, is Mary Gentle, who's a British writer. I don't know. Yeah. Her early novel, Golden Witchbreed, is a novel of, it's in that sort of anthropological thing where there's one person from a technological society walking around on a new planet and investigating the new planet. thing, and I loved it to pieces. And then there is a sequel called Ancient Light, which spoils it in a lot of ways for me. And it just does that thing where I cannot forget Ancient Light to reread the Golden Witchbreed that I used to really love. And it's not that Ancient Light, in this case, it's not that Ancient Light is a bad book. It's just that she's taking it in such a radically different direction from the direction of the original book and the direction I wanted it to go. And also kind of ending the world. And I didn't want that world to end. I didn't want that world to go away and end. I wanted that world to stay there. So that is a sort of interesting thing about reading and rereading, that there's almost this fear, particularly when there's been a long gap, that the sequel can't possibly be the sequel that you want. And then sometimes it is. Like perhaps The Stars Again, perhaps The Stars was the book I was waiting for, completed the series in a beautiful way, putting in a capstone in a really great way. And then there's nothing better than that then when it works. There's just this slight fear when it doesn't.
I'm always reluctant to read the last book in a series because what if I'm disappointed in the ending? It took me, I don't know how many years it took me to finally read the final books in Cage Baker's Company series. I was so terrified of how it might end. And I was happy with the ending, but it took me a long time to be ready to read it.
Yeah, it is very different experience if you are satisfied than if you're not satisfied, and I entirely understand the hesitation.
Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. Our guest today is Joe Walton, author of Or What You Will and An Informal History of the Hugos. Listen to this episode and others at retrorocketspodcast.podbean.com. One of your books that has pride of place on my bookshelf is actually your nonfiction book. I'm actually looking at the book right now to make sure I get the title correct. It is your Informal History of the Hugos. I remember loving all of your articles on Tor.com. I use this book as a reference book for myself of, you know, do I think I'm going to like this book? Well, you know, what was Joe's comments on this? Oh, she said this book was kind of meh. I'm going to skip it this go around. While you were, and I realize a lot of these essays were written many years ago, while you were writing those essays and working your way through Hugo nominated works, what did you do when you came across something that you had absolutely no interest in reading?
I didn't read it.
That's genius.
And then I said in the book that I didn't read it. When I started doing that series as a series of blog posts, with no idea of it being a book at the time, it was a series of blog posts. And when I started doing it, I thought, what am I going to do when I haven't read something? And I decided that rather than be a completist and try to read the things I hadn't read, I would take the fact that I hadn't read it as information. I would take that as a data point. And so what I'm doing in that book, as you know, is I'll take the five Hugo nominees and look at them as a set, look at the winner, but say, are these five books the best books of the year? And then I'll look at all the other books of that year. I'll look at what won all the other awards. I will look at things that were published in that year and didn't win any awards. And I will say, well, are these the five best books? Is there something they left out? And I thought that I would have very overwhelming answers of, yes, generally they're the five best books, or no, they're not. Whereas in fact, I had a very unsatisfying answer that it was something like 67% they're the best books of the year, two-thirds of the time, between 1953 and 2000. My personal opinion, my informal opinion, is that they did pick the best books of the year. And when I did that and I treated my not having read it as a data point, I would talk about why I hadn't read it. And sometimes I wouldn't have read it because it's a book in a series and I've read the first book in the series and I didn't like it and I wasn't going to read the others. And sometimes I hadn't read it because it looked awful or other people said it was awful. And sometimes I hadn't read it because there hadn't been a British edition at the right point or whatever. So there was some sort of marketing reason. And occasionally then I would read something that I'd missed and write about it. I read Lee Brackett's The Long Tomorrow, which just hadn't had a British edition. I'd never seen it. I'd never come across it. But it was in print when I was doing the series. I was like, why have I not read this? There is no good reason why I've not read it. I'll read it. And I read it. And I read about it. And it's a really good book. And I'm really glad that I read it. So if there was something that I hadn't read, but I did have an interest in reading it, I read it. But if I didn't have an interest in reading it, I would say that. And that's why it's called an informal history of the Hugos rather than a comprehensive history of the Hugos. There are actually plenty of people who've read every Hugo winner or even all the nominees. But that wasn't what I was interested in doing. I was interested in looking at the whole year. And it was obvious I wasn't going to read every book from every year. Like 1953, I could have read every science fiction book that was published that year. I almost have without even trying. But 2000, that'll be like 800 books.
Yeah.
You know, just not happening. So since I couldn't do that, it's a consideration of what I've read. It is a personal look at the Hugo Awards. And then, of course, when it was a blog series, they would put it up every Sunday morning. And other people participated in the comments. And it had the best comment thread ever. And people would say what they thought of the books, of the other books. Rich Horton would come up every week and talk about the short fiction in detail, which I put in the book. And Gardner does, wow, these wonderful, wonderful comments. And I just had this amazing experience where loads and loads of people were waiting every Sunday morning for the post to go up and then participating in this great conversation about the year in an excited way. And it was wonderful. And it was that made me think, you know, we should make this into a book. And very unusually for a book of blog posts, we should keep the comments. And we did, Patrick and Teresa Nielsen Hayden, my editors, came up here to Montreal and we printed out the entire thing. They printed it out in the office. This giant stack, you wouldn't believe how huge the paper stack was. And we went through it on paper, deciding which comments we really wanted. All three of us went through it, and then I went through it all again and decided. And then I, of course, pared it down on the computer. But doing that on paper worked so much better than doing it on screens would have been. So we had different colored pens, and we all marked this and did this, and it was really fun. And then I had to go through and edit the whole thing into a book. And then there was a delay with publication. It was ready to be published in 2015. But because of the whole puppy stuff, the puppy kerfuffle, they were reluctant to publish any book that was History of Hugos that wasn't about that. Because I wasn't going, I wrote the original post in 2010. And I stopped 10 years before in 2000. And so it's a book that stops in 2000. And there was nothing at all about that. Both we felt that people seeing History of the Hugos would want there to be stuff about that. And I had no desire at all to go right up to the present day and to write about that and to do that. So it was held back and it wasn't actually published until 2018. So it was even more out of date when it came out than it was when I wrote it. But I'm glad you're enjoying.
I don't feel that it's out of date at all, and I like that it is just you're your informal, off-the-cuff thoughts on things when I'm looking for older fiction to read that I haven't already read, your articles and the comments that were published in that book, and I can always go back to Tor.com and see the entire comment thread, that is exactly what I'm looking for to know, okay, should I read this book? Should I not read this book? Is this going to work for me? Am I going to put this book down 20 pages in? So it's not out of date at all for me.
No, it's not out of date. It is just talking about older books rather than more current books. And I think it's actually important to talk about older books because things kind of fall out of the conversation. And there's a lot of really great things out there that are older and well worth revisiting, as well as a lot of tosh that is good that it is forgotten. And having some way of raking through to tell the difference is valuable.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. I love new books, but they get enough attention. They get enough blog posts. They get enough, well, not all of them get enough marketing, but so many older titles, they're just, I feel like there isn't room in the current conversation for them, and I want them to have that space because there is so many wonderful books that were published.
Actually, this is the first time I've talked about this, but it's a great moment to drop this into the conversation. But I do program for a small convention in Montreal called Scintillation. And we had it in October of 2018 and 2019, I'm sorry. And we were going to have the third one in 2020, and of course it didn't happen. We just had the third one now in June of 2022. And we're going to continue having it in June because it seems like a safer time when people can be outside. And we did a lot of things. We had picnics instead of parties and things like that to make it safer. And it's been 2 weeks now since we had it, and we did not, touch wood, have a single COVID case. So I think we really sort of dodged the bullet. What we were doing was right, and we're going to be doing it next year, and we're doing this. And we've decided, but not yet announced, but we have decided that we are going to give awards that are going to be called the Scintilla Award. And they are going to be for books that are 4 years old, that were published 4 years ago, with a moving forward 4 years ago date. And we're going to have one for a genre novel. We're going to have one for something that is published on the edge of genre. So a genre book published as mainstream or something like that. We're going to have one for something published in translation. And we're going to try to get the translators to come to the con because translators don't get enough love. We're going to have one for nonfiction. And we're going to also have one that I'm not involved with, which is going to be for graphic work, a manga or bande dessinée, or indeed graphic work in English if there's something that people like. But while we were talking about it, every single thing that I heard mentioned was originally in either Japanese or French. So what do I know? But I don't read that. I'm a very bad nominator for that. But I'm going to be on the jury for the others, and we're going to be looking initially at 2019 and then moving forward and doing that just purely to get attention to older books. Because 4 years ago, the book is still in print and it can still do the author some good to have some attention, but these are going to be, it's not going to be the best book of 4 years ago. It's going to be the best book of 4 years ago that didn't get enough attention. So it won't be something that was Hugo nominated or Nebula nominated. It'll be something that just not enough people were looking at, but that were great. But it gives our nominators, which is everybody who goes to the con, everybody has a membership. And indeed, everybody who's ever been to the con is going to be able to nominate. But it gives our members who are readers a pool of things that they've drawn on that are from those years that they can then sort of nominate and get there. And we'll make a short list and we'll release that and it'll get some publicity for those books. And one of our members is going to make a ceramic trophy that'll be the prize. And we're just sorting out the details of how we're going to do this. And I need to sort of do the grown-up thing of writing press releases and sort of telling people. But this is what we're going to do. So I'm telling you first. You're the first person who's not in scintillation who's heard this. And all of you who are listening out there, you're the next people who are not in scintillation who've heard it.
So for everybody listening, how do we register for scintillation? And how do we send in our nominations? Because 2019, so much wonderful books flew under the radar.
So Scintillation, it's scintillation.ca is our website, and you can buy a membership. But I think actually at the moment, we don't have dates because the hotel have been a pain. We don't have dates for 2023. It's going to be an early weekend in June, but we don't yet have dates, so we're not actually selling memberships. We will be really soon, like within a couple of weeks. Probably by the time people listen to this, it'll be there. And then there is also going to be a web form for nominating on the Scintillation website. And we also have, Scintillation has a very active Discord community, which is our 24/7 online thing that I started in March of 2020. And it is a very active community. And as soon as I started talking about this there, everybody was throwing titles in the air, as you can imagine. So we've got a volunteer who is collating everything. But I've said that this year, at least, I will look at everything that people suggest. I won't necessarily read it, but I'll look at it. And if I might well have read it already, but I'll look at it. And if I haven't read it, I will look at it and I will decide if I want to read it and if other people want to read it and sort of give it at least a look. Because, yeah, 2019, it's exciting. I can see that you are excited at this idea.
Very excited.
I think there's a lot of... Also, you should come to Scintillation. You'd love it because it's a group of readers and writers talking about books. It's exactly what you would enjoy.
I knew I got that real ID driver's license for a reason. For listeners, I live in Michigan. For listeners in border states and possibly elsewhere, I'm not sure, you can get a Real ID driver's license that lets you drive across the border, I think, double check, you can use that driver's license to drive across the border and you do not need an active passport. So I can come to Scintillation next year.
You can if you drive. We actually had one person drive from Ann Arbor this year. That is certainly an option. I recommend everybody who lives in the US get a passport anyway.
Yes. Yes.
Get a passport. You never know when you might need a passport.
Agreed.
You have that, also get your real ID driver's license. Come to Canada anytime you need to.
I've already got this this back of my mind. Hope no one from the government is listening. I already have this back of my mind plan to use that real ID to drive across the border and apply for asylum or get on a ship that's going somewhere or something. One of these days, I promise, I will get a passport, but I can at least drive across the border.
Yeah. It takes a long time to get a U.S. passport. But anyway, you will be able to come to Scintillation in your car, with your real ID, and we'd love to have you here. And we have a lot of fun programs about books, older books. It's really great. I really enjoy doing program for it. Other people do all the hard work, and I just do the fun bits of running a convention. And I get all the credit, and they don't get any credit at all when they do all the work. And it's very unfair, really. But there we are.
I used to do programming. I used to sit on panels, and I haven't been in a number of years, probably since 2019, at Confusion in Detroit. And it was very fun to do panels. I miss it. And there were so many folks there that did all the hard work behind the scenes. And
yes.
And they're the ones that need to get the applause and the attention. I just show up and I blab for 40 minutes, but they're doing all the hard work.
Science fiction fandom is a great place to meet people to talk about books, and very welcoming, but it is all volunteer run, so sometimes it gets chaotic because volunteers. But it is very welcoming to new people generally, which is something that not everybody knows. I wish I'd known that earlier, that I could have found friends in that community earlier than I in fact did.
And it's, you know, thank goodness for Discord, thank goodness for Twitter, thank goodness for the internet. This is how we can find people that don't live near us. You know, my childhood was always trying to find fellow nerds that lived near me, that went to my high school when I was younger, that went to the same day camp. And I mean, just truly, thank goodness for the internet. I can find people now. I can find my fandoms.
Yes. Yes, I absolutely sign off on that one. Yeah, thank Herbies for the internet.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the internet, it's just this morning I was saying to myself, my goodness, Twitter is such a dumpster fire. But there is beautiful things to find, and there is wonderful people to connect with, and private Discords are just the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
Any fun or funny stories from Scintillation that just occurred a couple of weeks ago?
We had a person whose first scintillation it was, who is a philosophy professor, and I'd run across him in a role-playing game, and he was into books a lot, and I invited him to the Discord, and this was during the pandemic, and he came to the convention and exhibited all the behavior that you normally associate with like a 17-year-old girl, but he was a middle-aged man, and he was sort of completely dumbstruck on meeting writers whose work he loved. And it was just adorable to see that. And we have a huge age range, which is one of the really nice things. Even this small convention this year, we only had 80 people, but we had people from if you don't count, we had some kids brought by parents, but people who just voluntarily came on their own, we had an age range from 19 to over 70, which is really pretty great. And seeing everybody accepting everybody's enthusiasm and doing this was just wonderful. And we had a raffle because we were slightly losing money doing it at this size in the hotel. So we had a raffle to raise money and do stuff. And people donated so many things and so much money as well. We raised so much money. But people made things and donated them that were really beautiful and lovely, and books and all kinds of sort of really, really gorgeous things. And it was just so heartwarming. There are some things that make you feel human nature is just really great. When you read a really great book by somebody you've never heard of before, when you get that kind of generosity, when you see people just reaching out in that way, the entire existence of Patreon. Oh, I also have a Patreon. You know, I should have mentioned this. Blue Joe on Patreon. But when you see Patreon, where people are paying for things that they could absolutely be getting for nothing, and they're just paying just to support the creator.
Because we want to support the arts. We want to, we need to.
Marvelous. You know, just the existence of this kind of thing. It is very cheering. And I'm a very optimistic and hopeful person. Even when the world is terrible, I'm trying to find the good things that I can find. And my general direction is up rather than down. even when it's hard. And I'm not saying it's easy.
But we have to. We need your optimism everywhere. We need to wrap up here in a moment. If you want to take a minute and just let us know again, where can we find you online? What's your website? Do you want to share any social media?
Yeah, my website is joewaltonbooks.com. My Patreon is Blue Joe. My podcast is Ex Urbe Ad Astra with Ada Palmer, and we talk about craft of writing and books and stuff on that, and so podcast people would probably enjoy that. And I am Blue Joe Walton on Twitter.
Fantastic.
Lovely talking to you. It was really fun.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. This was absolutely wonderful. The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.